You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Harold Trinkunas. I direct the Latin America Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program here at the Brookings Institution. And I'm happy to welcome you to our event, Converging on the Future of Global Internet Governance, the United States and Brazil. Before I'll be moderating the panel, please do join us during the conversation today. If you would like to live tweet, we're using the hashtag InternetGov, as is up on the screen. But before I introduce our panel, I'd like to just take a couple minutes to talk a little bit about what motivated us to write the report that we're launching today, which hopefully you had a chance to get a copy of on the way in. It's a report that I co-authored with my colleague Ian Wallace at the New America Foundation, based on field research we did last year in Brazil, as well as research here in the United States. And what originally motivated the research was actually the Snowden surveillance revelations and the reactions around the world that the two of us saw to that incident. The decision to focus on the United States and Brazil arose from the fact that Brazil was one of the most prominent critics of the U.S. Surveillance role in the wake of that scandal. But what we ended up finding as we went through this project is that instead of this being a research project about surveillance and cybersecurity, the global internet governance story ended up being by far the more interesting and, I think, significant aspect of the project. And our report, in fact, focuses on what we see as an emerging opportunity for change in a topic, in a debate, international debate, which has, in a sense, been stalemated at the international level in some ways. And so what we do in this report is look at how both Brazil and the United States have shifted course in the debate on global internet governance. Brazil, from its traditional criticism of U.S. dominance of this space and its advocacy for multilateral diplomacy as an alternative to existing multi-stakeholder approaches to internet governance, and the United States opening the door under the Obama administration to changing aspects of the present global internet governance regime, particularly the internationalization of ICANN, as a possible alternative to the current arrangements that we have in place today. And so these two countries together, by converging on some ideas on how to change aspects of global internet governance, have in a sense opened the door through which we may see a new approach or a somewhat different approach to global internet governance in a way that we hadn't seen before. We had seen, in fact, the stalemated debate between the United States and its allies and, on the other side, the Russians, Chinese, Brazilians, and Indians focusing on the multilateral process through the UN. So to make sense of this, the possibility that we might have some new options on global internet governance, we thought it made sense to look at the United States and Brazil together to think through what the possible alternatives are as we move ahead. I mean, of course, it makes sense to look at the United States. I mean, the reasons are obvious. It was a pioneer in the creation of the internet. Many of the governance practices that we today see in the global internet governance space are, in fact, inherited from practices developed in the early days of the internet in the United States. But Brazil is also an important actor to look at in the global internet governance debate for several reasons. First of all, as an early participant frequent critic of the present internet governance model, as a large democracy that was critical of present global internet governance arrangements, as a country with a highly successful domestic internet governance model based around multi-stakeholder arrangements. In fact, Brazil and the United States, when we look at them together, illuminate sort of alternative options for available to democratic societies to preserve what we now have, which is an open, free, innovated, unfragmented global internet. Looking at these two countries together as we do in this report, I think helps us think through what is the present state of the debate on global internet governance, what are some of the key issues that have to be resolved as we look ahead, and what are some of the options that are available to countries as they deal with the public policy issues associated with the existence of this global internet that we all depend on. Let me just take a few minutes now to offer brief introductions of our panel. We have a very distinguished panel here to talk about these issues. And you have their biographies in the handouts that were available to you as you came in. But let me just highlight a few things about each of my colleagues. Our first speaker will be Ian Wallace, who's a senior fellow in the International Security Program and also co-director of the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, also my co-author in this report, who will be going into a bit more detail about the substance of what we found. He previously served as an official in the British Ministry of Defense with a focus on cybersecurity issues before also serving at Brookings and now at the New America Foundation. He'll be followed by Daniel Kill, am I pronouncing that correct? Okay. Yes. Who is a senior policy analyst at New America's Open Technology Institute. She has worked on a range of internet governance and internet freedom issues and has served as an advisor on internet-related issues to U.S. delegations to significant multilateral conferences on internet governance issues. She'll be followed by Carolina Rossini, who is the Vice President for International Policy and Strategy at Public Knowledge, originally from Brazil. She's a lawyer who's worked on intellectual property and internet policy, previously also associated with New America Foundation. I think I'm noticing a trend here. The Electronic Frontiers Foundation and also the Berkman Center at Harvard University. And finally, we're joined by Paul Toomey, who is the CEO of Argo Pacific, an international advisory firm, but somebody with long experience in the internet governance space. In fact, the former CEO of ICANN and also chaired the governmental advisory committee in the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. So somebody with deep experience, direct experience with the kinds of global governance issues we will be talking about today. Without much further ado, I think I'm going to turn it over to Ian to lead off the discussion. I expect each of our speakers will speak about 8 to 10 minutes, and we'll follow this with a sort of a Q&A session where I may take the moderator's privilege to ask the first question or two. Go ahead, Ian.
Harold, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming to listen to us talk about this report. It was a lot of fun writing it, and I think actually hopefully provides a slightly new perspective on an issue that a lot of people are talking about. The report is first and foremost a policy paper, and like all good policy documents, has a list of policy recommendations at the back, recommendations for the United States, for Brazil, and for what we call the global internet community, which is, we don't say it in these terms, but essentially shorthand for those people who actually make the internet work. But it's also a history of the internet up to this point. Or at least internet governance, albeit told in a slightly unconventional form, and Harold explained the reasons why we took this approach. And so in order to appreciate how we got to our policy recommendations, I think it's probably important to give you a sense of our telling of the story. And so before I summarize in essentially three sort of thematic areas, the recommendations that we gave. Let me offer you four key milestones, or at least dates, on the journey towards the circumstances that led us to make the recommendations that we did. The first of those dates is 1974, and this is the date when. Or the year when Bob Kahn, VinSurf, and others published TCP/IP, which is the protocol by which networks are able to connect, or it's a protocol by which internet networks are able to connect with one another. And the key point here is the triumph of TCP/IP over all other protocols for connecting networks. And I think now we look back to the sort of foundation myths of the internet, back to the ARPANET, and assume a sort of natural progression from there to where we are now. And I think our point is that this was by no means inevitable. There were many governments, particularly in Europe, who saw governance of the internet basically being built off the same governance structures that govern telecommunications, which were very governmental and were organized sort of, you know, within an organization that become part of the United Nations. The triumph of TCP/IP sort of happened for a number of reasons, not least of which it was free and had lots of backing from the United States government behind it. But that the consequence of that is that the academic culture behind the creation of ARPANET and the slightly anti-establishment, certainly consensus-based approach that had informed that suddenly became the basis on which what became the global internet was rooted. And so you get this sort of slightly paradoxical situation where the US government essentially owns this, but that this sort of oddly non-governmental structure is at the center of it, and therefore you have essentially the beginnings of a multi-stakeholder approach, and that becomes very important going forward. Second year is 1995. 1995 is the date of the establishment of the Comité Gestor d'Internet, or CGI.br, which is the organization in Brazil that was established when the decision was made by the Brazilian government not to impose a state monopoly on the internet in Brazil, but rather let the private sector have its way. This owed very much to the United States, and it's not surprising perhaps to learn that the people who brought the internet to Brazil had been educated and had been to America to bring the internet to Brazil. But the effect of that was it enshrined at the center of the Brazilian internet once again a multi-stakeholder approach. And the significance of that, however, is twofold. One, it was a particular take on the multi-stakeholder approach, just sort of rather corporatist, which evolved over time with different people having sort of assigned positions. But it also meant that at the point when Brazil came into the center of internet governance, they had a sort of a reference point, a multi-stakeholder reference point to go to. And there's some debate about how effective CGI.br has been in sort of the development of the internet in Brazil. But the fact that they exist is almost the most important part about that story. The next year is 1998, important for two reasons. Firstly, it's the year it is the year when every single country in the world was connected to the internet. And perhaps not surprisingly, or perhaps related to that, that was the year when countries really began to become concerned about the digital divide and what the internet was doing to their business, which prompted decision at the International Telecoms Union plenipotentiary to suggest a world summit on information security. It's also the year that, due to commercialization of the internet over time, the US government decided to essentially privatize the allocation of names and numbers and established ICANN, but did so in a way that they didn't feel that they could completely let it go, so kept a string of control on it, put it under contract to the Commerce Department. And then over the years that followed that, in 2003, 2005, the World Summit actually happened, and you get a debate which has shifted now that ICANN existed to a question of how governance ought to work, and basically ended in a compromise where different roles were allocated, governments were given a role in public policy, but essentially what emerged was the status quo, that the multi-stakeholder approach continued, and actually the One Innovation, the International Governance Forum, reinforced the multi-stakeholder approach. And then finally, you get to 2014, post the Snowden revelations, as Harold was saying, and you'll recall, and the hosting in Brazil of the Net Mundial, which is a conference inspired at some level by the CEO of ICANN, Fadi Chahadi, who saw the risk that Dilma Rousseff, president of Brazil, who was personally upset about the U.S. spying on her communications, would take Brazil in a very unhelpful in the direction in terms of internet governance, and essentially got alongside her and said, look, there is an opportunity here for you, Brazil, who've traditionally had a foreign policy which has been defined as sort of slightly anti-United States. Snowden has given you the opportunity to be anti-United States by being more pro-internet, more pro-Monti stakeholder, and with CGI.br, and I think the Brazilian foreign ministry to some extent sort of realized that they had to support this, created Net Mundial, which provided a basis for which the multi-stakeholder approach could be embedded within sort of discussions of internet governance that went well beyond names and numbers. So that gives us the sort of context for three different sets of policy recommendations. The first of those policy recommendations is around the IANA transition. And it's our view as we sort of work through this that it is increasingly, and I think this is shared across the internet community, increasingly untenable for the US to continue in its role of having a contract for, you know, one small area but a symbolic area of internet governance with names and numbers, and the importance of transitioning that into a more international model. How that's done is under debate at the moment, but there is a limited amount of sort of pushback within Congress and other places about whether that should happen, and our recommendation is that it's in the U.S. interest to get that process complete. Second, around the WSIS plus 10 process, it's a 10-year review of the outcomes of WSIS, which is going through the United Nations at the moment. Our main focus there is on recommendations for Brazil and the internet governance community, try and encourage Brazil, who since Net Mundial have been riding two horses, essentially, a multilateralist, this should be done within the United Nations, sort of exemplified by their foreign ministry, who sort of reverted to type a little bit, and multi-stakeholder approach, exemplified by other parts of the Brazilian government. And our argument is that they should back the multi-stakeholder horse and use that as a way of sort of demonstrating international leadership, taking the Indians who've recently sort of signed on to this idea and others with them in a way to ensure that internet governance doesn't get pulled down and distracted. The UN can't actually do a great deal substantively to change things, but it could. Get in everybody's way to distract people from the really important issues of internet governance over the next few years. And the final recommendation is around the Net Mundial Initiative. The Net Mundial Initiative was an idea, again, I think, that probably the brainchild of Fadi Chahadi and much less of a triumph than Net Mundial itself, to take forward what came out of Net Mundial as an ongoing process to provide a multi-stakeholder framework for discussing some of the public policy issues that go beyond his sort of day job at ICANN. And I think that my own view, I think Harold's view as well, is it's a great idea that's been badly implemented. And choosing the World Economic Forum as a partner has been controversial in some parts of the world. And as a result of this, ISOC, the Internet Society, have said, you know, that they're not supporting the Net Mundial Initiative, which was clearly not a great undermined the initiative to a certain extent. But our contention is that if not Net Mundial Initiative itself, then some way of having multi-stakeholder discussions in a way that it involves governments but isn't totally dominated by governments is actually a very good thing for the internet. And as a result of that, you know, we are encouraging the Brazilians through CGI.br, who are the third partner in the initiative, to push to make that more inclusive in a way that it can fill a gap that we think exists even beyond the existing IGF opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much, Ian. And before we turn to Danielle, I just wanted to point out to you that in any discussion of internet governance, there are many, many acronyms thrown around. And we actually have a on Roman numeral 9 of the report, you'll actually find a list of the acronyms used in the report, but many of the same acronyms are being thrown around up here at the front table. So that might be helpful to you as well. And you'll, on the opposite page, find the policy recommendations and executive summary. Danielle, why don't you take it away?
Thanks. Thank you, Harold. And thanks for having me here and for writing this very helpful, I think, and very interesting report. I will say also the acronyms don't get any easier the more time you spend working on this because they're all very similar as well. We find that a lot in the IANA transition. So there's a bit of background, and I think Harold touched on this a bit in the introduction, but my perspective on this, I come at this issue both as a researcher and an observer of global internet governance processes, and then also as a participant in some of them. So my research on internet governance at New America has focused on U.S. foreign policy related to internet governance, particularly post-Snowden. So what has changed and what the Snowden revelations have done in terms of the viability and credibility of the U.S. Internet Freedom Agenda, which is one of the major State Department initiatives around internet-related issues, not just internet governance, but it encompasses many of those issues. And with a recent emphasis on the IANA transition and the questions that are currently being debated about ICANN accountability. So in that capacity, I've written reports and have also done some work trying to help educate Congress on stakeholder perspectives on the IANA transition, sort of what's happening in the community process, why we should let that go forward, why the IANA transition matters, but what's at stake as well. But I've also served as a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Telecommunication Union's last plenipotentiary conference, which is the meeting they hold every 4 years to set their agenda. And have participated in multi-stakeholder forums like the Internet Governance Forum, which Ian mentioned. So I've seen this from a number of different angles, including both sort of the multilateral and the multi-stakeholder side of the process. So with that, I'd like to talk a bit about the U.S. perspective and what's happening here. I think to start, this paper and sort of the analysis makes a really excellent and an important point about this deadlock between the multi-stakeholderists and the multilateralists, or whatever you want to call them. I think it's sort of this idea about where and how we should be creating processes to govern the internet has slowed progress on actually dealing with the problems that we're trying to solve. So developing common solutions and best practices for issues like digital inclusion, like cybersecurity, like net neutrality, we can't get there a lot of the time because we are fighting about what type of system we want to use to get there, what the word multi-stakeholder means, what kind of model that is, rather than actually trying to solve the problems. And I'm not saying that to diminish the importance of that debate, but to say that from a perspective of solving these issues, it is, I think, generally recognized that it's a challenge. And I think since the WSIS, you've seen that sort of nowhere more like poignantly come up than in the discussions around the International Telecommunication Union and sort of the push and pull about what its role should be in internet governance, which is important because the ITU is a UN agency. It's actually long predates the UN. It was originally the International Telegraph Union. And its role is to facilitate the global interoperability of telecommunications networks. So the question that's been the sort of center of the debate for the past few years and before that is this question about whether it should work on internet governance issues at all. And so when you watch the negotiations happening at a place like the Plenipot, what you see is the sort of push and pull for whether or not we should have language or references to the internet at all in the documents of the ITU, in the treaties and in the resolutions. And you actually see this sort of very funny references to what happened during the WSIS process, where there were sort of a document that both reaffirmed the multi-stakeholder model but also talked about the importance of governance. I think people have different favorite references that they try to push into these resolutions, whether they, depending on whether they support the multi-stakeholder or the multilateral model. And it's very interesting. And it's particularly interesting from a U.S. perspective because the United States has always argued that the multi-stakeholder model is the way to go and that the International Telecommunication Union should stay completely out of these issues. And that aligns very well with the sort of global internet community perspective for the most part, because they're both sort of perceiving a common threat to the multi-stakeholder model. For the U.S., I think there's a variety of reasons. There's you know, genuine support for the model that was developed in the U.S. There's also an interest in a model that still favors U.S. influence much more so than the multilateral model would. And for global civil society, it's a question of what forum or how they can have a seat at the table. Because in a multilateral system, governments take the lead and they can decide who gets to sit in the room and how and when and in what capacity, whether they can speak, whether they can participate at all. So it's very interesting. What it means is that they sort of have these two strange bedfellows that are pushing for the status quo in these forums. The outcome that they want is for nothing to change because they're sort of trying to stop a threat. And from a public policy perspective and from thinking about solving problems, that's, I think, a little bit absurd for that to continue, in perpetuity. And it's increasingly difficult, after the Snowden revelations because of the general distrust of the U.S. So with that in mind, sort of getting back more towards what we're talking in the what you're talking about in the paper, I think the NetMundial meeting last year was important for the reasons that are outlined in terms of what it means for the shift within Brazil, but also critically important for the evolution of this global multi-stakeholder model. I think there were a lot of concerns going into the meeting about how it came about what it would do, how it would relate to the Internet Governance Forum. But I think at the end, what happened was people actually saw the multi-stakeholder model work to a large extent, and create an actual outcome document that people generally felt pretty good about. It didn't give everyone everything that they wanted, but nothing that is trying to operate on consensus is ever going to do that. So I think that's very important. I think the other thing that happened last year that obviously is sort of a critical turning point and happened about around the same time is this announcement of the IANA transition and the decision that the U.S. is going to give up its last bit of oversight over ICANN. And it's a critical piece of this story because I think in the paper observes sort of very aptly that since the Internet originated in the U.S., a lot of the governance policies and practices have been developed in this sort of organic and piecemeal way. This is a very good example of that. The ICANN system is an outgrowth of the fact that the Internet started as this small technical and research network in the U.S., and it's made it a political target in a lot of ways. Its relationship with the United States, its origins, and that's been a huge challenge, and it's been a distraction for a long time from greater public policy issues that need to be solved. And since Snowden, there's basically no chance that it's going to continue that way. So what we're seeing now from that perspective is the U.S. government and the global community and other governments actually stepping up and trying to figure out how to solve this problem, which is a fascinating process to watch. It's a very important one. And I think the great part about it is that if it succeeds, we can move on to solving all of these other issues. And I'm very optimistic that the IANA transition is going to happen still, obviously not on the timeline that was originally outlined that came up yesterday in the hearings in Congress. But what will be fascinating after that is where the U.S. goes next, because it was a big step forward to decide to give up oversight of the IANA functions. It was a big step forward to endorse the NetMundial meeting. So we're going to have to see what steps the U.S. takes going forward after that, where the United States government is willing to give and in what forms they're willing to engage to actually, I think, sort of start moving towards a place of progress rather than protecting the status quo. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Danielle. And I think your last comment highlights actually an important larger point that we could make, which is in general, how does the United States think about engaging with the rising powers as it thinks about the international order and building support and legitimacy for existing institutions by making adjustments that accommodate some of the interests of these emerging powers, such as Brazil. Carolina, why don't you take over now?
So first, I would like to thank Harold and Ian for the invitation and also for our dialogue over the past months on the report. Was a wonderful process to really reflect on, I think, this historical inflection point that we see nowadays on internet governance. I think that happening, which is when it started almost a decade and a half ago, and we are seeing that happening now again with the convergence of two strong countries. And I think for me, it's very interesting to see what is my role on all of that, as Danielle started. I started almost 15 years ago as in-house counsel for the biggest ISP provider in Brazil. And at that time, there was no civil society working on these issues in Brazil. And it was very interesting to see how important was to play a role of translating and translation and education to policymakers in Brazil and also the academia community, which I was part of, to really start creating this field and understanding how technology would actually impact in the long-term development of Brazil. And I think that was it's a very helpful way of seeing this need for constant translation of what's going on, because that's our role actually at Public Knowledge, where we try to translate not just to the American Congress and policymakers, but also to the civil society globally, really always trying to educate and bring and create new opportunities for engagement for those, both in Latin America, which is one of my priority regions, but also through partners in Asia and Africa and Europe. I think that training and that empowerment, I think it's really important to always have prepare and expert people at the table, opportunities for engagement at through the multi-stakeholderism process. I think they're just going to grow, and we need to be prepared for engage. So I think that's one of our biggest roles that we play, that we started playing when we were at New America Foundation and now at Public Knowledge. And I think it's the paper came out in a very... I don't know if it was a coincidence or plan, you tell me later, but in a great moment that actually we see that convergence, that future already happening. If you guys have followed the visit of Brazil to U.S. The last week of June, you actually see this convergence clear in the papers and in the communique that came out of that visit. And I think that was really important because a lot of things that I said and wrote when the Snowden revelations came was the that U.S. had lost its legitimacy in the internet governance and policy worldwide, because U.S. was seen as a leader on freedom of expression and open internet and things like that, and with the Snowden revelations that hegemony was lost, that leadership was lost. And I think this process of engagement of U.S. and willingness to engage both through multi-stakeholder participation but also with some leading countries like Brazil and India and Japan and others, it's really important to rebuild this trust. And I think that we are now, and I mentioned about inflection, because I think this communique that came out on June 3rd is the clear expression of rebuilding that trust, right? Brazil went out and knocked on the door of UN, the door of the Commission for Human Rights, to come out with that privacy resolution with Germany. Brazil is working on projects on privacy with Germany and China, for example. And that was a reaction to say, okay, what do we do that now we may not be able to trust U.S. at least for a while, right? But I think U.S. did a concerted effort to really bring back Brazil and allow conversations. It's a gigantic change. If you see when Dilma canceled her visit to U.S. in October last year or 2 years ago, and now she's back visiting U.S. She came, and I think that's a very important also move for Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil. I don't know if that news has arrived in U.S., but the last survey of her acceptance by the Brazilian population, she's down to 9%. So she's in a very, very, very delicate moment inside Brazil. That links of trust between the Brazilian society and Dilma is about to be ruptured. People are talking about impeachment. I doubt that would happen, but I think that's also show why she brought a gigantic caravan of business with her, because she needs to rebuild also internal links. And this business now in Brazil, they want links with U.S. For the first time, there are real talks of establishing a bilateral trade conversations. Brazil had refused to be part of ACTA, for example, and now that those conversations are back in terms of our meat finally is going to be able to arrive in U.S., lucky all of us. And I think there's going to be a lot of efforts, both by Dilma and U.S., and that's a very opportunistic time for Dilma to actually rebuild trust with part of the Brazilian society, rebuilding distrust with U.S. And distrust is not just on internet governance. They communicate in a series of areas, from environment to food to sustainable development goals and so on. So I think that's a very interesting moment to observe, and let's see how that's going to reflect on the acceptance of Dilma inside Brazil. Brazil also plays a very important geopolitical role, and I think U.S. is well aware of that, and I think that's I see an enormous amount of investment of time and attention by the State Department and other organisms in U.S. regarding Brazil. Brazil is the lead of the G77. Brazil is an important player at the BRICS, also to kind of balance a little bit what's going on with the other less democratic countries part of the BRICS. Brazil is a leader in Mercosur. Brazil is a leader in cybersecurity in Latin America, asking less help from OAS, the Organization of American States, than the other countries. Brazil already has an agenda, a white paper, and a center for cybersecurity. Because Dilma really bought into the multi-stakeholder process, even the military is now talking with civil society to implement our cybersecurity agenda. So it's really interesting moment to see Brazil moving forward and to see Brazil adopt a culture that actually was not natural, right? We never had many town hall meetings like it's part of U.S. since U.S. was founded. This is very early. CGI was one of the early experiences of multi-stakeholderism in Brazil. The Working Party actually tried something like that in the 80s regarding participative budgeting and financial issues, but that never really worked through Brazil, just in a couple of cities. So I think it's really interesting to see that consolidated, not just with CGI, but also with Congress on a series of initiatives and policy-making processes. Marco Civil was not the only law that came out from a crowdsourcing style participation. Many others actually came out through that similar processes. And I think I'm very curious to see how the future going to move and how the communique, all the lines establishing that communique will move forward. Brazil and U.S. do have a concerted effort to move forward the social development goals, and they have recognized the ICTs as an enabler, and they are working on making IST ready, like the readiness of ISTs to enable social development goals. And I think moving forward, there are some processes that worth paying attention to, which is the WISIS process that will culminate in the December meeting in New York, but also all the cybersecurity processes moving forward. We now world that more than 25, I have that number, I'm not sure right now, but it's like 20 to 30 countries already have cybersecurity agendas and are moving towards the London cybersecurity process. I think those two areas are very important to observe and how Brazil and U.S. will act together and in convergence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carolina, and especially for highlighting how the internet sector in Brazil was really a pioneer in terms of civil society participation in governance. And really, I think what the report highlights is the extent to which this is also a case where Brazilian civil society and public opinion really influenced the formulation of foreign policy in a way that's actually rather unusual in Brazil, and in a sense helped to overcome maybe some of the traditional inclinations towards multilateral processes, which are the preferred mode for Brazilian diplomacy when it interacts with the rest of the world. So thank you for doing that. Paul, if you could close us out.
Thanks, Harold, and thanks to you and Ian for the paper, for writing the paper, very important paper, and for the invitation to be here today. Some people in the audience may pick up, I'm an Australian. Just a little, two things, a little bit about my background and then therefore my approach in the next 8 minutes on the paper. I was in the 90s permanent secretary or head of agency for the body in Australia that coordinated all information economy issues for the federal government. So I was the senior bureaucrat looking after all this stuff worked closely with the White House and others, both in private sector and technical communities, but also the governments of Japan, Canada, the United Kingdom and the European Commission in response to the Green Paper and the eventual formation of what became known as ICANN. I was the chair of its government advisory committee for 4 years, and then so I was trying to escape. Vint Cerf persuaded me to come back in and be the CEO for the next 7 years. For the last 5 years, run a cybersecurity and other advisory firm, do a lot of work in internet governance, particularly in China, Middle East, Eastern Asia, some parts in Europe. And that will all reflect a little bit my comments that I'll now make. I'm going to assume that you've, if not read the paper, at least had a quick glance at the recommendations in the front page or two and might have some sense of the history here, but if not, well, bad luck, that's what I'm going to assume. First thing I'd say is congratulations to the authors in writing the paper. I think it's important. I think picking out these linkages and the roles between these countries is very important. To me, it's very self-evident because I've lived this for the last 15 years, but I recognize that for many others, these linkages and this interplay is not self-evident, and yet it is an important part of framing the ongoing international discussion and confluence around internet governance. I'd also make a couple of sort of more general observations. Congratulations for picking up the role of the Office of the President of Uruguay, Fadi, and also Hartmut Glaser at CGI in terms of influencing Dilma at the right time, probably, I think, against traditional advice both from the foreign ministry in Brasilia and also, frankly, residual advice left over from the advisors to Lula. Lula's own advisors were not at all of that view. So I think that was a significant change, and I think that indicates yet again that serendipity, opportunism, and tactical responses are very important in international relations. We tend to write this stuff like big tactics, but let me tell you, it rarely works that way, I think. The other thing I'd make an observation about this multilateralist, multi-stakeholderism, I think it's worth unpacking it in a number of ways. Multilateralism is often seen to have its origins in the Treaty of Westphalia. I think there's two parts of the Treaty of Westphalia that's worth pulling apart. One part was the whole coming to the end of the wars of religion in Europe, that each state was equal, that all states could interact with each other. This idea that states coming together being treated equally was the way to convene balance. I think actually at Westphalia, all ambassadors sat down at the same time, literally at the same time, this sort of stuff. That was one part of it, and that we often think of this as the multilateralism, the so-called, as the Chinese often call for, democracy in international system, which is one country, one vote, that sort of stuff. In other words, limit U.S. power. But the other side of the Westphalian system was that the prince got to choose religion. So bad luck, Doesn't matter where you live, you get to get the religion of the prince. The multilateralism and internet governance debate is the latter, it's not the former. The people who come to internet governance debates to about multilateralism really don't give a stuff about one-to-one government and all that stuff. What they care about is I'm the sovereign and I get to decide in my own country. I get to choose your religion. So I think we should keep that in mind, that multilateralism, as it gets referred to in this arena, a lot of it is actually sovereignism, if you want to put it that way. It's about sovereign control around the around networks and communications. The multilateralists tend to be the people who made the internet work. They tend to be the people that just came together and make this stuff work. A lot of it's supported by liberal democracies because that's the way they do their domestic policy making. You know, everybody can turn up and scream in your ear if you're in the government. Therefore, if stop complaining to me about it, go sort it out yourselves is sort of a response. And that's sort of part of the origin of multi-stakeholderism. But it's also, frankly, a set of discussions around a set of global elites. You know, elite intellectual property lawyers and elite technical people. You know, it's not a broad-based thing. It's got civil society, but it does tend to have a set of international elites. And because the United States was the first mover in the internet, the U.S. has had a very strong advantage. And so in that system, it's not unusual that other people who resent the U.S. power or are skeptical about U.S. power see U.S. power behind the multi-stakeholder perspective. I would point out that China's probably shifting at the moment partly because it's building a very large internet base and industry at home. The Net Mundial initiative from Brazil has achieved several things. One, I do agree with the authors that it's allowed a space for the Indians in particular to move. And we have seen in this June a group of ministers from India finalise a sort of on-again, off-again process that's been going on in India for well on 10 years to move more strongly behind multi-stakeholder approaches. I think the Brazil move has made a big difference to that. I wouldn't underestimate, however, the quiet diplomacy from the US and European countries and non-governmental actors like, for instance, the International Trade Union Confederation in trying to influence people in India and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, especially since the WICCET meeting in Dubai, about the benefits of multi-stakeholder approaches. And I think, I wouldn't want to put it this way, but a skeptic could say that the Brazilian move has been an interesting stalking horse for others to come behind. And so I think there's been a lot of quiet diplomacy going on in this arena from other players. My own view a little bit on the Net Mundial initiative itself. The authors say the Net Mundial initiative, which intended to build internet governance capacity around the world, could provide a further avenue for developing countries to access advice and assistance in solving difficult internet public policy issues and advance the internet freedom agenda. This is a perspective from the Western Pacific more. I think the jury's still out on this. Net Mundial does not bring financial resources to the task, nor, frankly, was the UN ever going to. The WSIS is full of all sorts of commitments, but we know what that means. They weren't really going to bring financial. You know, the market's going to bring the money to this issue. And I do think, and this is, I'm sort of exaggerating a little bit to make a point, but I do think Net Mundial has a continuing legitimacy deficit in the eyes of many governments. I think in my region it probably does. It's not clear, I think, in the Western Pacific, and maybe I'm drawing too long a bow here, but it's not clear in the Western Pacific as to why Brazilian leadership is in itself significant. The US at least invented the internet and is the world's leading technological power. Brazil's neither of these. Further, the invitation process for the first Net Mundial was seen by many governments as chaotic and bordering on capricious. There was no clear mechanism, unlike, say, the WSIS process, or IGF, etc., which came through a traditional UN process, whereby people understood how the invitation process would work. And I think that's contributed to an ill ease concerning legitimacy. The development of the draft statement from the first Net Mundial upset people like the Chinese, particularly the Indians who had problems with it. But I think stuff got out really quickly. So people knew there was a draft that had been floating around Brasilia for a while, right? And so there was this sense of we're being railroaded into some Brazilian thing that works for Dilma, and she's got an election coming up in the next 12 months. You know, that sort of analysis, at least in the Western Pacific, was fairly common. So I'm not trying to say Net Mundial is a bad thing and that there's opportunities going forward. I think there are, but I think it starts off with a legitimacy deficit that will take. I don't know how you overcome it and how you upgrade it vis-a-vis the IGF. And so that's the other issue on the policy side, I think, is important to think through. How do these two things link together? The IGF, I think, comes with legitimacy because it comes out of the WSIS process. There's all the concerns about it. I know there's all the criticisms of it. There's been more clear statements coming out of Net Mundial. Interesting question in my mind is where does the Brazilian government sit on these two? Some of the most recent statements around the IGF seem a little bit, maybe I'm reading them incorrectly, but they seem to be, we'll support IGF if it passes certain tests for us. Maybe I'm misreading, but that's what it sounds like. So in terms of policy, especially in the recommendations around for the United States in the paper, I would suspect it's not in the U.S. interest to see the IGF process undermined strongly by the Net Mundial. If the two can work together, I think there's real opportunities. I think definitely Net Mundial brings an increasing legitimacy out of the civil society side in terms of presentations of agreed statements, which there's a lot of positive aspects on. I'll be fascinated to watch the Chinese perspective on IGF now that they've decided to be engaged in Net Mundial at the next level. Now, I expect that's probably driven a lot by their BRICS policy, but I'll be interested to see whether they then come back to their traditional view in the UN of the UN should be a multilateral system and we shouldn't have multi-stake. I don't know whether they're going to or not, but that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Another couple of observations very quickly about the Brazilian processes on this space for the last 10 years or more, and this is a practitioner's response. I think, like other Latin American countries founded at the beginning of the 19th century, Brazil, excuse me, very much an outsider's perspective, seems to me to have an inclination. It seems to have been influenced, it seems to me, by Napoleonic Code and early U.S. legal traditions in having an inclination to prefer sort of law-legitimated organizations and mechanisms with an ability to, you know, find a home for my problem in a century-delineated head of power. I'm always interested when I go to Latin America generally, and you'll see plaques on the wall where people, you know, President X has opened Y, and there's a statement under what legislation, under what provision of the Constitution actually in the plaque. And I don't know how much it happens across Brazil, but it's interesting across Latin America when I stop in buildings and you see that. Speaking as a citizen of a parliamentary democracy whose constitutional framework essentially is some sort of derivative of a medieval monarchy, this need for explicit constitutional power statement is overly limiting. And I can tell you Australian ministers do not like the idea at all that they can't simply make policy. You know, they cherish the ability, I can make policy on this issue without having to go back and find what's that link back here, what's this sort of logic step back to some constitutional head of power per se. And I think that, plus the sort of corporatist aspects that were referred to earlier about the nature of the CGI model, meant that sometimes some of the Brazilian proposals from the foreign ministry prior to Net Mundial, which were, we should have a place we can all come to where we can solve our problems, and the thing looks very much like the CGI placed internationally, was quite alienating to many countries. I mean, I know it got discussed probably more than the Brazilians understood in various capitals, but part of it was why? And this doesn't work for me domestically. So this corporate aspect, which the paper refers to quite well, I think, is another area where there's a dissonance. Certainly in the Western Pacific, there's a dissonance about how you do domestic policy and who gets to talk to you and how that works. So it's just an observation. My final observation, I think, also on just thinking back on for a period of time about Brazilian and Brazilian interactions and how much the Net Mundial thing has been a real change, is that I think there has been quite a degree of conflict in the 2000s between the Brazilian foreign ministry and its domestic ministries. I think they've had different perspectives. They're not the only country. On issues around internet governance. I think also what was interesting is there was an ongoing debate between Anatel as the telecom regulator and CGI about what was the model in Brazil. Again, far from an unusual circumstance, and quite a fight for influence in Brasilia. I'd also make the observation a little bit about the IANA transition. I do think that's going to go ahead. I do think the timing was talked yesterday. The one observation I would make about the IANA transition is never underestimate the capacity for governments to say one thing publicly and another thing privately. So throughout, especially the Bush administration, when there was a lot of criticism of the United States government and Europeans and others would all come out calling for, you've got to move on this IANA transition, you'd be amazed how many then came to this city and privately said, it's fine, leave it alone. So they would say one thing publicly and a completely different thing privately. And so what's been interesting, I think, once this administration has moved on the IANA transition, frankly, the degree of a little bit of ill-ease by the same countries going, okay, it looks like the Americans are moving forward, I hope this all works, which I think is interesting. So I might just leave my comments at that.
Thank you very much, Paul, for those very interesting comments and for highlighting the fact that this is still very much an issue under debate. And though, even though we do see some convergence among governments, there's still some doubts. There's still governments that don't speak with a unified voice, either here in Washington or in Brazil. So while it was encouraging to see that the joint communique, as Carolina pointed out, by the U.S. and Brazilian presidents at the end of the President Rousseff's visit a couple weeks ago, explicitly calling out the multi-stakeholder process as the preferred option, there's still very much, we sense, I think, in the paper that there's doubts within Brazil and between the foreign ministry, Anatel, and the CGI, about what the appropriate direction it is to take on the future of this debate. We've had I think our panel has had a very full discussion, and I think we have some time now for some questions and answers. I see people already putting up their hands. I won't take the moderator's privilege because we've gone a little bit over our time up here on the panel, and I'd like to give some time for Q&A. The one thing I would request is I'll keep a list and call on you. If you could just wait to receive the microphone. There will be microphones out on the floor. And if you identify yourself and your institutional affiliation, that would be most helpful. And I think Vinny had the first hand up in the back.
Hi, Paul, and everyone. I'm Vinny Markowski. I'm actually ICANN's Vice President for UN Engagement, so the topic is very near and dear to my heart. You talked about, some of you in the audience also may know that there is a WISIS plus 10 debate going on right now at the UN. It started last week. I urge everybody to join in and follow what's happening there, because some of the items that you are discussing in your paper are being also reviewed at this intergovernmental discussion, which includes also all other stakeholders. Do you think that, or how do you see the Brazil role vis-a-vis the UN discussions on WISIS plus 10? And you talked about the IGF continuation and stuff like that, but that's only one small part of the WISIS. I mean, the WISIS Tunis agenda is huge, and by the way, I understand, kind of the conversation was focused only about ICANN in like 90%, but ICANN is not even mentioned in the Tunis agenda, and the top-level domains are mentioned, I think, three times. So do you think, what are your expectations to the authors, but also to the other panelists, whoever feels comfortable to respond, with regards to the process in New York at the UN? Thank you.
Terrific. Let's take a couple more round of the three questions. I think we had a question over here, and then I'll come back to the other side. Yes, and here's the mic is coming to you.
Oh, thank you.
And then we'll come back.
Having come down with a summer cold, a mic is helpful. My name is Bill Jorn, and I'm executive chairman of a startup called ROI3. which is creating apps for the developing world. And what brings me here is to try to understand the evolving structure of the Internet world as it will proceed in over the next several to 10 years. However, I have to first say that only jokingly, but as a sad product of a Jesuit liberal arts education, I really am overwhelmed by Mr. Toomey's reference to the Treaty of Westphalia and bringing that forward to the Internet age. Tip of the hat to you, sir. We're looking at what the structure of the Internet world will be 5 years from now as far as the company is concerned, but I'm sure everybody here is also. Am I misconstruing it, or is it fair to say that the Internet world, through the multilateral approach and so forth, will be, in effect, deconstructed, and maybe reflecting on the de-Americanization papers that have been out there for several years, and somewhat reconstructed on a regional basis or a country basis? Reference was made to India. And if so, could the respondents tell us how that's going to look worldwide in terms of regional structures in several years?
Thank you. And I think we have one in the middle, I think the gentleman with the white tie. And then in the next round, we'll come back to you.
Hi, Alex Sanchez from the Council of Hemispheric Affairs. This question is actually for Ms. Rossini. You talked a lot about Brazil's leadership role in Internet governance. What do you think is the situation of the internet in Brazil today? Companies like Google, organizations like the Committee to Protect Journalists have declared that Brazil is one of the leading countries that requests content removal within Brazil. There was that congressman, Edmar Moreira from Minas Gerais. He sued 38 journalists 44 times to have content removed because he didn't like what people were saying about him. There have been controversial laws like the Acevedo law, the Dickman law. What do you think? What's your position on these controversial laws, and how does the Brazilian government try to remain a leader in Internet governance when it's been pretty repressive at home? Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. I think what we'll do is we'll just go straight down the panel, and panelists, you just address, you don't have to address all three, pick out what you want to address among the questions that were raised just now.
So we'll pick up the second question, and I think it leads into an answer to Vinny's question. I think what we will see over the next decade or so is a convergence between how the world organizes generally and how Internet governance is conducted. Internet governance is conducted. And so you will therefore get a mix. The multi-stakeholder model itself is in some ways a confusing construct. There are many elements of operating the Internet that are quite properly the business of governments, particularly around security. There are other aspects that are purely the responsibility of the private sector, and some bits that are done sort of by civil society on a sort of personal basis, people sort of chipping in their time. I think, however, what you're going to see is, you know, global governance is going to become increasingly distributed both geographically, sort of rise of the rest, increasing involvement of, you know, countries outside the U.S. in global politics, and that non-governmental organizations are going to take an increasingly important role. And that will be reflected in the way in which Internet governance has to work, because governments can't do it all themselves. I think that the challenge is getting the right people making the right decisions, and that's basically what NetMundial and what WSIS to a certain extent is all about, so that the particular decisions lie with the right people and the right groups of people are consulted in coming to those decisions. And I don't know where that's going to end up, but I suspect it's going to be less governmental than global governance has been historically. Linking to Vinny's point, Vinny's question, I think Brazil has quite happily been riding two horses, the multilateralist horse and the multi-stakeholder horse. I hope that in the WSIS plus 10 process, they become stronger advocates for a more multi-stakeholder approach. And I think, you know, reflecting the way in which, you know, the Indians are moving, that there is a hope that that will take place. But I think, you know, the to Paul's point about the sort of back room lobbying from US and Europeans, I think there's a good deal of work to be done to persuade them that it's actually in their interest economically in other ways, as well as, you know, a good thing to do for global society.
I'll jump in very quickly using moderator's privilege to just add a couple points address the first couple questions. I think what the report identifies in this moment of convergence is that there's real progress that's been made in the debate on the processes and procedures by which you make decisions about internet governance, something that that Danielle pointed to in her comments in the last couple of years, and potentially even more progress will be made in the next 2 to 3 years as the U.S. And the various the IGF, the WSIS plus 10 process resolves itself, the Net Mundial initiative becomes whatever it becomes. That process part of it is working itself out. And it has to, because what the other thing that's going on, the other important trend, and this is not my observation, this is actually Ron Dibert make this comment, is that the internet user base is basically shifting south and east. And that's bringing a whole group of people with different values and ideas about governance processes to the table, or with concerns about the public policy issues developing around the internet. And in many ways, the solutions the United States found as the first mover, which were sort of ad hoc and organic and were taken up as the issues became relevant, may not form sort of a coherent package of answers that are useful or attractive or, you know, even can be implemented by many of the governments in sort of the global south and east. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks. And I think you make that last point about sort of reconciling the values and considering the values of the much larger internet user base than the one that existed when a lot of these governance structures were first created or conceived is a critical point. I do think, you know, in response, I'm responding mostly to the question about sort of what the internet structures look like in 5 to 10 years. There is a real risk and a real debate happening right now about this issue of fragmentation. So this question, and some of this was sort of pushed to the forefront, I think, also by the Snowden revelations, which was sort of this reaction that by a lot of governments that, well, if we're being surveilled on the global network, if the U.S. has this outsized amount of control, we'll build our own networks, our own internal intranets. We'll have email routed, only within our country as much as possible. We'll have European clouds or Brazilian data localization or all these sorts of proposals. They certainly did not originate with the Snowden revelations, but I think that sort of pushed it as a global conversation about this issue. And I think the reaction to that has been to point out that there is a risk in fragmentation both on an infrastructure level and a risk in a governance level if we start to sort of try to pull the internet apart in that way. And I mean, not physically, but, well, actually you could do it physically as well, but sort of this idea that if we, if we have different approaches to different things and different values, that means we should just divide it up and everybody governs it their own way. It's a global network. It's built technically to route information in the fastest way possible. The security protocols, everything is built on this idea of it being a global network or the vast majority of it. So it's important to keep that in mind. And I think there are a lot of people that are going to sort of in the next couple of years from government, from the private sector, and from civil society, work very hard to make sure that fragmentation is not what happens. But I think the other piece of that is that there's going to be sort of a course correction in the governance questions about what are actual internet governance questions, what are national questions that are dealt with within a country, what are not internet issues at all, right? Because there's a risk that as the internet becomes a part of everything that we do, from education to healthcare, that everything becomes an internet governance issue. And so I think we're starting to see that, and that is there's a risk in that. And so I think considering sort of in the next 5 to 10 years is this process of what of people determining what are internet issues, what are the global ones that we need to ensure that we think about on this wider scale, and how do we fight against a risk of fragmentation that could undermine sort of the value of the network or make it harder for people to connect. But without ignoring the fact that there are different values and that it's a network now that covers the entire world and populations with much different perspectives than just sort of the academics and researchers who started the network 20, 25, or more than 25 years ago, but who were sort of the primary users 20 to 25 years ago.
Thank you. Carolina?
Sure. So I'm going to address your question and your question, of course. I think Danielle went to the point that I also wanted to make, which is the topic of fragmentation. I'm not as afraid of it as a lot of people are, just because economic facts show that might not happen. And even with the data centers in Brazil, people knew that would not mean that Brazil would be completely fragmented. I am concerned, though, when you see fragmentation. Well, we have to see fragmentation in all the layers of internet, even like the behavior layer that Zittrain considers, right, where you have even privacy issues there. And while I don't think, while I think fragmentation is very hard to happen in the infrastructure layer, at the end of the day, even more because companies are there. More than 70% of that infrastructure is private. They need that peering traffic, et cetera, et cetera. I am concerned that they do happen at the content layer, for example, through both privacy regulations and intellectual property enforcement, like DMCA-like, or even censorship issues that I can mention later. But at the same time, there are other concerted efforts that are actually binding that are different from the traditional conversations in internet governance, which are the trade agreements, right? Trade agreements are binding and they make international law that transforms into federal law when they are signed into and ratified by Congress. U.S. nowadays is involved in many very, very important trade negotiations like the TPP, the TISA, the TTIP, and a lot of other acronyms. China is trying to do something to counterbalance TPP in the Asian region, and all the trade agreements there, and at least for the past 10 years, and I have a publication coming out on it later this year, have internet-related norms. Not just on the content side, like DMCA-like norms, but also DNS regulation, critical resources regulation. And when that comes and knocks in the countries, that does fight for free flow of information in all levels. Free flow of information, I have some critics towards to it when it considers privacy in Europe a barrier. But it is important to keep the internet from fragmenting and to keep freedom of expression has a core value there. I think a lot of laws that are coming that people see them as laws that point to a fragmentation are actually more laws that cause jurisdiction conflicts. So, for example, Brazil decided to not adopt data localization, but it said that ISPs needed to protect and guard the logs of and store the logs for policy and judiciary enforcement later of any company that offers service to Brazilians. So you don't even need to be placed in Brazil. You don't need to have an office in Brazil. But even if your marketing is towards Brazilian, like Alibaba, right, Chinese, the jurisdiction is of Marco Civil. So you're going to have that pressure, and it's very hard. And like Spain and France now, with the right to be forgotten, they want to assert their jurisdiction regarding .com, like Google.com. So they would delist the results, not just from .fr or .es, but also .com, right? So the jurisdiction is what concerns me a lot. I think it's something to observe how countries will assert jurisdiction beyond their borders. It has always been a problem in internet and is being more. But I'm going to leave like that. On your question, you're right. And that's not just Brazil. That's a lot of countries, including U.S. DMCA was abused many times, right? The good news in Brazil is that we do now have the Marco Civil Law that clarifies how content can be taken down regarding defamation and honor and other issues. Unfortunately, the copyright issue was taken out of Marco Civil, so we are still waiting for the reform of the copyright law, which is like happening since 2003, and I'm not sure how it's going to proceed. So at least we do have clarity for part of it, how it happens. We do have a Supreme Court decision on ISP liability for copyright, so that's also finally consolidated a very conflicting results from around the country, all very similar to DMCA. And we do have a privacy law coming for the first time in Brazil, because Marco Civil does not define what personal data is, so that was left for the privacy law, which is now finishing public consultations that was not actually just closed in June. So we do have some interesting things, but I think that law always comes later, right? You do have a lot of facts happening. You do have journalists being killed in Brazil. You do have bloggers. I write the Freedom House report for Brazil since the first version, so I'm well aware of those. So I think we need to push for other initiatives, not just law, right? We need to educate our judiciary. These issues were not taught in law schools until the mid-2000s. And you also need a collaboration with civil society, and you have Article 19, for example, in Brazil, training journalists on how to protect themselves. One challenge issue in Brazil is that anonymous communication is not permitted by our constitution. So let's see. We have not started discussion encryption, so let's see how that's going to play now that journalists are actually learning how to use encryption.
Paul?
Harold, I need to make a couple of observations. First of all, when I was an Australian, I hear you talk about south and far east. I hear west and near north. Vinny, I can't talk more on the Brazilian thing than others here, really, on Wizards Plus 10. The fragmentation question, I just make this observation. At some level, the internet, in a very crude sense, is three layers. It is the layer that transmits. It's the protocol layer that makes 350,000 networks operate as one network. And then there's the application layer. The bottom layer has been basically run by telecoms regulations now for the last 30 years, so it is essentially nationally and regionally rule-based. The middle bit, which is where the ICANN thing and Regional Internet Registries, et cetera, fit in, that's the goose that lays the golden egg. It is the global commons. It is the thing that makes the internet, not a whole series of national intranets or even sort of company intranets. That's why the fight about this is so important. And there are pressures on that. There's some recent changes from the MIIT, well, recent enforcement of MIIT rules in China, which are even beginning to show some pressures around how that works. But that's still a thing which, it's part of the reason why ICANN and them were so important in the discussion, because it was always about that. But the above level, the application layer, is where all the content is. And most governments worry about content. The United States government says it's all First Amendment until you mention the word internet gambling, and then for the last 15 years you get a different response altogether. All around the world, the content issue is at the application layer. For your this potential business concern, providing that middle bit stays stable, and I think it will, the real question is how do you develop content that meets the customs and expectations around content for the places you're targeting. So I think it's relatively stable going forward if you're trying to plan a business. But there are pressures, particularly coming out of parts of China. I expect we'll also see it out of Russia, which will tend to push back on this idea of sovereign control or a sovereign network.
Okay, thank you. We're almost out of time. I had one more person on my list. Maybe we could take one last quick question. go ahead. I think we had somebody here at the front. Just if we could keep the questions very brief, the one in the back and the one in the front.
Sorry, I didn't see.
Right here in the front.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm Charles Chen from the IT Industry Council. So my question is sort of follow up Paul's answers about what's your approach or what's your policy recommendation for those emerging markets or developing countries like China and Russia, who used to be very government-centric in governance, but also developing very fast in internet development. So what's your approach to advocate them for the best practice in government, internet governance?
That's actually an excellent question to end on. Let's start with Paul.
The Chinese government's just released their Internet Plus policy 1st of July. It's actually the third time they've released it in some respects, but and it reflects the State Council's view that the Internet is a major driver of economic change and reform in China. So I think in all of these countries, the role the Internet presently has in terms of driving down transaction costs across the economy and improving societal interaction is strong and we recognize as such. The question becomes how much do you want to be part of an international and how much do you want to be domestic? That comes partly down to your model of political control. But I would be strongly emphasizing, what I would be strongly emphasizing in all those countries is that be careful about things you might do that cut off your nose to spite your face. So there are some instances I won't talk now, we could talk privately later, I know of in some countries where people are moving to implement things that they think they're being told by their political control elements are important to do, but the consequence of which is going to be they're going to cut off a whole lot of interaction with international parts of the internet, and I don't think that's their intent, they just haven't thought it through yet. So that's the very hard-nosed pragmatist in me says I'm not going to persuade the Politburo in China or anybody else to move away from the political control systems they want. The real thing is to think about, you know, don't cut off your international interaction. And this is a single internet. You should try to have it as much as you can. And be careful about the unintended consequences of messages you send down inside the system.
Anybody else? Well, I think we've just about run out of time. Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking our panel for a very interesting discussion.